Chapter 18, County Borders. Absolutely fascinating chat with this morning's FedEx driver. He came to collect my rucksack from the B&B I was staying at Manningtree, a pokey little place staffed by a portly little family just off Key Street. TripAdvice, the towels smell of mince. Still, I'd slept well, and I was in good cheer as the driver came to collect my rucksack. We exchanged pleasantries. I asked about van driving. He asked about my walk. And I explained I was using his company's services to ferry my bag onward each day, an ingenious form of kick and chase. He frowned a little and we had a brief chat about costs, and to cut a long story down a bit, he explained that doing this every day would cost me close to £900 over the course of the walk, money I just don't have, or rather I do have, it's just not liquid right now. So I sent him on his way, and I am now carrying my bags again, which, in a daft way, I prefer. I thanked my lucky stars I told my assistant to buy the most expensive rucky she could find. Peace of mind. Manningtree sits slap bang on the border between Suffolk and Essex. A new dawn, a new county, I say out loud as I begin to walk. And though crossing a county border is always a thrilling experience, I feel sad to leave Suffolk behind. There's a lot of twaddle spoken about the rivalry between Suffolk and my own county, Norfolk, but I don't buy into it. Our real enemies are those counties further afield with designs on our loyal band of repeat-visit tourists, your Devons, your Cumbrias, your Northumberlands, your Waleses. It is they who spread rumours about us. Not least, and let's confront this head-on because it's the elephant in the room, inbreeding. I have lived in East Anglia for over half a century, and I have never, never been made aware of, witnessed, or been involved in so much as a single act of human inbreeding. When it comes to allowing the gene pool to stagnate, we simply do not have a charge to answer. All right, you might say, it doesn't happen now, but it used to, and fair enough, it did used to. But what people fail to recognise is that East Anglia is in a remote part of the country. There's very little passing traffic there. So in centuries gone by, before technological advances such as the motor car or Tinder made it easy for people to make more genetically advisable choices, it was inevitable that on a cold winter's night, when everyone else in the house was asleep, a randy brother might walk down the corridor and gently knock on his sister's door. No, if you ask me, I say let all the peoples of East Anglia come together to fight this threat from rival counties as one, because it's together, by doctoring their Wikipedia entries, by leaving negative TripAdvisor reviews for hotels we haven't visited, that we can ensure our homeland retains its reputation as one of the world's premier destinations for competitively priced caravanning breaks, and thanks to Coleman's Empire, mustard holidays. I'd go further. Life in Suffolk is hard, so let's give our neighbours a break. I guess the most obvious option would be to subsume Suffolk into Norfolk. The new super county, Norfolk, a compound word made by taking the Nor from Norfolk and the folk from Suffolk, would seek to spread Norfolk's better educational standards and, let's not dodge this, the slightly advanced culture to our newest members. And with the name Suffolk consigned to the history books, before being quietly removed altogether in future editions, maybe, just maybe, our disadvantaged neighbours would have a fighting chance of a better future. To give me energy for the day ahead, I prepared my own take on the glucose sachets now favoured by endurance athletes and bin men with particularly long rounds. A far cry from the overpriced equivalents of the big brands, mine comprise of a spoonful of jam tightly bound in cling film. Whenever my performance starts to flag, I will just place one of the pellets, known colloquially as jam bombs, into my mouth. As I bite down, the jam bomb, not to be confused with the French word jambon, meaning ham, will detonate, its payload of thick fruit plasma oozing onto my tongue and into the mouth or mouths of my grateful taste buds. Cheers, Al. Love your radio show, by the way. If my calculations are correct, then I'll feel a brief high, followed by a sustained period of extra energy. When the slump comes, and it will come, I'll simply repeat and continue. Some sports scientists believe this kind of short-term jam dosing is bad for your health. Then again, sports scientists say a lot of things. It doesn't make them right. How much actual science is involved in being a sports scientist anyway? I mean them no disrespect, but they're PE teachers with laptops. I have breakfasted well on porridge and eggs, not in the same bowl, so I know it will be some time before I need to turn to one of my small sugary assistants. And so it proves. My mouth not triggering the first controlled explosion until I've been on the road a full 40 minutes. And then, kaboom! I'm taken back by how much better I feel and make a mental note to set up a call with the head of British Athletics. With top athletes constantly searching for even the most marginal gains, it's pretty obvious to me that jam, a product not yet on the World Anti-Doping Agency's list of banned substances, could be of serious interest to Team GB, or the grammatically accurate GB's team. With one bomb consumed, I quickly find myself reaching for the next. In an ideal world, they'd be taken on an as-and-when basis, but because they're one of the nicest things ever made, this is impossible. I want to stop, need to stop, but stop I cannot. Within 15 minutes, the jam is no more. All that remains is a mouthful of spent cling film pieces and a nagging sense of self-loathing. And then crash. The tiredness is overwhelming. I feel like a gorilla that's been shot with a tranquilizer dart, or just extremely tired. I try to power through, but I'm being naive. "Alan, you're being naive," I say out loud, but I'm so exhausted it just comes out as, "I have been naive," accompanied by some dribble. Every step is like wading through, I don't know, treacle? Fibogel? Camembert? Warm camembert? Basically, it's very hard. I stagger into the home of God, the Church of St. Andrew in the village of Mark's Tay, and make my way to a pew at the front. There's a service going on, but that's not my concern right now, and it's not something that bothers me. I lie down, tell the vicar to shush, and fall soundly asleep. 20 minutes later, I wake with a scream, a recurring nightmare about petrol prices, bid farewell to the congregation, and get on my way. Left, right, left, right, left, right. That's not my legs, by the way. It's my arms. It sounds weird, but my legs are actually doing the opposite. Right, left, right, left, right, left. And the combination of the two somehow leads to the act of walking. Like the old parlour game of patting your head while rubbing your balls, walking requires a real feat of coordination. I try not to overthink it. A boy at Cubs once told me that if you focus too hard on something that's confusing, you go insane. It's a fate I'm keen to avoid. As I head towards the district of Braintree, I begin to muse on the word Braintree. You can imagine it, can't you? A brain tree. Like an apple tree, except instead of apples, it bears human brains. I could think of a few broadcasters who could do with one of them in their garden. And yes, the amusing thought sustains me for a short time, helping to keep my ragged mind off the pain of walking. Of course it did. It's a funny thought. But is it going to make you laugh for any more than, what, 20 or 25 minutes? Probably not. And yes, you can muster up additional laughs by thinking up variants on the brain tree theme. I imagine there are towns called Spleenbush, Lung Shrub, Bowel Plant, etc., etc., and picture what the corresponding plants would look like. Funny, sure. And great, you've bought yourself another 20 minutes of amusement. But beyond that? No, I could feel my spirits slumping. Perhaps I'd bitten off more walk than I could chew. I snap myself out of it to notice I'm approaching Braintree. Is it me, or is there a feeling of anticipation in the air? The man walking a dog, the boy riding a bike, the lady driving a tractor. I genuinely did see this. Do they seem somehow expectant? I start to see dribs and drabs of people standing by the side of the road. 4 women on the left, a drib, 2 teens on the right, a drab. Soon the lines of people are thickening like a lorry driver's arteries. What's going on here today? A marathon, perhaps? An LGBT parade? A marathon's probably more likely, given the part of the world we're in. But either way, I can feel a huge sense of relief that the crowds are not here for Alan Partridge. Let me be clear, this walk is not about me, and the very suggestion that I might have dreamed it all up with one eye on a spin-off range of high-quality yet affordable merchandise featuring Alan Partridge hiking socks, bivy bags, jerry cans and flints is actually quite offensive. No, dear listener, we'll leave that kind of ugly careerism to the likes of Tony Robinson, brackets Channel 4's Walking Through History, and John Inverdale, brackets Channel 5's Feel the Power, a speedboating series in which John drives dead fast across the Solent with no top on. This one wasn't actually commissioned, but I know for a fact that Inverdale pitched it, so my point still stands, close brackets. My reasons for doing this walk are intensely personal, i.e. footsteps of father. And much though I sense the crowd would love it, that doesn't mean signing autographs or posing for selfies. I put on my headphones, crank my iPhone up to full blast, and nod approvingly. Dr. Alban, I say to myself, spot on. It's crucial for a rambler to get their song choice right. I live alone, so often find myself marching back and forth to pop songs. Stop the Cavalry by Jonah Louie, Portsmouth by Mike Oldfield, and The Safety Dance by Men Without Hats all lend themselves to a brisk hup, two, three, four, But as marching songs go, you cannot beat Float On by Modest House, brackets, a 2004 track I heard at an ice rink, because the singer sounds like Brian Ferry, whom I know from Tory party fundraisers. Time was I would have plumped for Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins. On long drives, my friend Eamon Holmes and I would play the Top Gun soundtrack at high volume. One would pretend to be Maverick, the other Goose. And we'd don Ray-Bans, talk in American accents, and keep saying we were the best of the best. But I just can't listen to this song now. Not for any painful memories, it's just a terrible piece of music. No, Albarn it must be, and Albarn it is. With the Doctor's distinctive Afro-European beats coursing through my veins, blocking out the crowds is a breeze. Admittedly, I do wave at them occasionally, but that's primarily a health and safety thing to ensure that they don't get in my way. And while my moonwalk does elicit a cheer, I only really do it to relieve cramp in the soles of my feet. But then something occurs to me. Maybe I've got this all wrong. I'm not saying this is the case, but what if these crowds are for me? Let's consider the facts. There are no marathon runners. There are no floats with flamboyant homosexuals in outrageous costumes. I love those guys. But there is an Alan Partridge. I didn't set out to publicise my walk, but what if someone else did? For many years, Dave Clifton was my arch-enemy, and in the late 90s and early noughties, not a day went by when I didn't wish him dead. In more recent times, however, we've buried the hatchet. We don't go drinking together because Dave's a big-time sauce junkie, and we don't go for meals together because that would be weird, but I do know that he now considers me a friend. Footnote. Indeed, he texted me last month with a message that simply said, "You are my friend." Odd. He also happens to be filling in for me on Mid-Morning Matters. Yes, there's every possibility. These crowds are his doing. Brackets, Dave, you're a good man. Whatever people say, you're a good, good man. Stay sober. Close brackets. Well, I hardly need tell you this is most unexpected, but I'll be honest, it feels good. All the naysayers, the doubters, the sniffers, the tutters, and that's just the staff at North Norfolk Digital, must now surely be opening their mouths wide, dislocating their jaws and praying their gag reflex isn't too trigger-happy as they now swallow their words. With everything now clear, I feel a smile beginning to form in and around the curls of my mouth. I wave. Two girls wave back. I wink at some chaps. The chaps fire back a thumbs up, each. I raise my arms and wave the wave of a guy who lands planes. And that, too, is met in kind. Yeah, I think. You love this, don't you? I do a little jog and pretend to play an imaginary cricket stroke into the crowd, then cap it off with a laugh and a get-out-of-here wave. Then I do a series of rapid points at various members of the crowd while mouthing, "You, you, you, you," before shouting, "Who loves you, baby?" I feel light on my feet, buoyant, cock of the frigging walk. I stand, hands on hips, letting them admire my stance, body and confidence. Then I'm off again. A little showbiz jog to the side, before leaning one way and cupping a hand to my ear, and then the other side, jog, lean, cup. And now I'm striding down the highway, my hands above my head, spanking each other rhythmically to the drumbeat Roger Taylor designed for Queen's pop song We Will Rock You. Dum dum chick, dum dum chick. I sometimes have a bit of a downer on the general public. They can be thick and uncultured. Footnote, the Great British Bake Off. But not this lot. This lot are amazing. I feel like I want to give them something to say thanks, a memento of some kind. I once saw a tennis player throw his sweatbands into the stands after victory, and whilst I thought it was disgusting and wanted to be sick, his fans seemed to love it. I don't have any sweatbands, so I rummage around in my rucksack and find a few things I can throw. As I ransack the rucksack, I see a banner. Held aloft by two housewives wearing a lot of denim, it clearly bears the Sport Relief logo. Yep, thought this might happen, I think, as I rifle through my bag. A lot of celebrities volunteer their time for Sport Relief, and my CV makes me just the kind of person they might ask to complete a televised endurance event for faraway orphans. This particular year, the organisers didn't come calling their busy people, and who can expect them to reply to every letter, but I'm happy to make that clear. "I'm not doing it for Sport Relief," I say, really rooting in the depths of my sack, "so you might want to remove the banner." "Eh?" chirped the denim girls in unison. That's literally what they said. But then this is Essex, and I'm aware they might not have had the benefit of a formal education. I smile and respond in a friendly manner, still searching for items to give away to the well-wishers. "Get rid of that banner, now!" I look down again. Ah, good. Clothes. And I stand up, ready to hurl a memento into the crowd. "But he'll be here in a minute," they reply, again in annoying unison. I'd assumed they were identical twins, but one of them's black. "Who?" I say as I pull my arm back, ready to launch a pair of my underpants high into the sky for a lucky punter to keep. And that's when I notice that there isn't just one Sport Relief banner. There are loads of them. In fact, all over the place I can now see people carrying Sport Relief collection buckets. "Steve Backshall!" The words hit me just as my arm completes its journey. Before I can register what this means, the scrunts have been flung. And as I watch them arc into a group of unsuspecting spectators, I grasp what this means. These people aren't here for me. They're here to support a Sport Relief walk being done by Steve Backshall, and I, Partridge, am effectively shelling them with unders. I wince and feel the tentacles of embarrassment beginning to climb my tummy like ivy. For those of you who don't know him, and I have to admit I'm not massively familiar with the guy myself, Steve Backshall is a TV presenter who makes animal programs for kids. His USP is that he films in exotic, often dangerous jungle locations, and while no shoot would ever be allowed to take place without a rigorous risk assessment that reduces the chance of anything going wrong to more or less zero, I've no doubt the shows appear extremely impressive, especially to the children at whom they're aimed. But despite the attraction of having a surname that sounds like a knitted garment worn by a grandma, Backshall's audience can only take him so far. Marooned in the no-man's land between Bear Grylls and Terry Nutkins, his career has hit a glass ceiling. Finding out that Backshall is due to arrive any minute, I decide to leave. Steve's a young fella trying to make his way in broadcasting, and even though it's not something that particularly bothers me, I can imagine how important the adulation of these people is to his self-esteem. The last thing he needs is an 800-pound gorilla stealing his thunder. I do track down the organisers and give them my number. As the senior broadcaster, I'd be happy for Steve to call if he needs any advice on how to handle the media, how to grow his brand, or indeed how to knock some of the rough edges off his presenting style. But with that done, it's time to get on my way. I make a quick foray into the crowd and collect my undies. "Sorry, thanks, sorry, bye," have a quick altercation with a middle-aged woman, and continue south. Footnote. The pants weren't dirty, they were unwashed. Big difference, sweetheart. Chapter 19. River Can and Alan Can. I spent last night in the Oakmoor Guest House in Braintree, where for £89 I got bed, breakfast and a wake-up call I hadn't asked for. I have no issue with those who wish to rise at 4 a.m. What I do have an issue with is when those people, or in this case that blackbird, proceed to spend the next 4 hours hollering from the top of a tree. I'm well aware that males of all species are randy in the morning and the blackbird is no exception, but surely his desire to make love to a lady bird, i.e. a female bird, has such a low chance of success at that time in the morning that he'd be better off flying down to ground level and finishing himself off in a bush. And while I don't run through all of these details with the landlady over breakfast, I do suggest that since I've only had half a night's sleep, perhaps she'd like to charge me half a night's rate. She doesn't go for this idea, but you see, the thing is, she's dug her own grave there, because later today, I'm going to absolutely rinse her on TripAdvisor. Today is day 6, Thursday, and I'm heading towards Chelmsford, home of the River Can, whose very name hums with positivity, just like I always do. I've now completed a third of my journey, and my legs are stronger and bulkier than ever before, especially the left one. My father would have reached here in about 90 mins, where it's taken me 6 days. But that's not the point. In fact, you could argue that the slower I go, the more I'm honouring him. Also, today's cars are faster than in my father's day, so if I'd driven, I'd have got to Dungeness in less time than he did, which would effectively be like mocking the dead or dancing on his grave. The break of day has brung rain. Bucket loads, in fact. Which is kind of funny, because in order to collect donations towards my charity of choice, I am now carrying a bucket. I don't remember if I mentioned I'd be raising money for the needy, but I am. It's something I had in mind long before yesterday's run-in with the Sport Relief mob. It just so happens that by weird coincidence, I chanced upon a rather lovely bucket shop this morning, and it seemed silly not to get one. Technically it was a Sainsbury's, but it did sell buckets, so I'm still being accurate. I know there'll be a few idiots who suggest that I'm using charity to boost my profile, like a long list of other celebrity do-gooders or did-gooders, not least Backshall, but like a fully functioning helicopter, I shall simply rise above that. As to the charity I'm supporting, well, I've given it careful consideration. After all, ours is a nation not lacking in good causes. There's Help the Aged and Barnardo's, and even charities for animals, supported by a growing number of people who haven't got their priorities right. Yet if you're truly going to throw your weight behind something, it's important you're passionate about it. Consider Help the Aged. Don't get me wrong, I have no axe to grind with or at the elderly, but am I passionate about them? Of course I'm not. Why would I be? Besides which, I am on a journey in the footsteps of my father, a journey that will take me all the way to Dungeness A nuclear power station. I'd be letting myself down, no, I'd be letting my father down, if I failed to pick a charity that was relevant to this. Founded in 2011, the Alvin Weinberg Foundation is the world's first pro-nuclear charity. With an ongoing mission to support the safe and sustainable use of nuclear energy, the foundation runs numerous advocacy campaigns and has a very well-respected outreach program. Unfortunately for me, however, its name doesn't fit on my bucket, so in the end I just go with Alvin's Foundation. And by lunchtime I've raised over £60 for a power source that will surely play a key role in our nation's future energy mix. I do admit to feeling a slight twinge of guilt, but that's only because some of the money might have been donated because people assumed Alvin was a little boy with leukemia. By 1 p.m, the weather system has put an end to my charitable endeavours. As the heavens open and the rain sheets down, I can't help but wonder if the Environmental Brigade have found out what I'm up to and performed a rain dance at Greenpeace HQ, no doubt accompanied by an Enya CD. Chapter 20. Tilbury and the Blood of My Heel. Friday is day 7 and something of a red letter day as I reach the banks, but not the building societies, of the River Thames at Tilbury. It's a major milestone in my journey, and I celebrate in fine style with a pack of wafer-thin ham from Asda. Admittedly, it's a moment that would have had more significance if my father had passed this way, but there's no road crossing here, so he would have used the Dartford Tunnel a few clicks west. As for me, well, I had to come this way because Tilbury is home to one of Britain's largest shipping container terminals, and it would have been a bit weird of me not to take a look. Tilbury is one of the most ancient ports on the Thames. A fort was built here by Henry VIII. It's where Queen Elizabeth I once came ashore to inspect her army, and it's even believed to have been the site of a Roman settlement. But, as I say, I'm not really bothered about that stuff. I'm more interested in the London Container Terminal. For as well as handling a variety of bulk cargo, mainly timber and cars, the terminal is also the main UK hub for importing paper. I ask the man at the gate if they do tours. He says they don't. I ask the man at the gate if they do tours for VIPs. He says they don't. I ask the man at the gate if they do tours for VIPs who keep out of everyone's way and promise not to be a nuisance. He says they don't. It's fun to stand over the road and watch the terminal at work, my mind afizz with images of timber and cars and paper. I love the sense of mystery. What treasure lies within each container? Is it timber? Is it cars? Is it paper? As I marvel at the sophistication of the computer-controlled crane system stacking the containers, I have a vivid sense of how the world will be when robots take over in about 20 years' time. Bill thinks it will take longer. This is Bill Oddie, by the way. He's been with me all day. But he's wrong about this one, and I think he knows it. It's good to have Bill with me. It's the kind of comfortable friendship where both parties can happily share a silence. And we do, for the best part of 3 hours, so that it becomes increasingly unclear whether we're sharing a silence or I'm just putting up with Bill's. It may very well be that I cast him into a sulk when I said seagulls were the jackals of the sky. I don't even know what I meant by it, but I saw his cheek twitch, and I think it was the last thing either of us said. As we head to the ferry port to take the short crossing over to Gravesend, Bill gets a text on the bird phone. The mobile he keeps exclusively for alerts on rare bird sightings. Someone's just spotted a white-crowned sparrow in Dorset, and I am sorely mistaken if I think he's going to miss that. He calls an Uber, and before I can say boo to a goose, not that I would when Bill's around, the diminutive birdaholic has packed himself off in a Dorset-bound cab that will cost him £200 I know he doesn't have. Fare thee well, old friend, with your noculars, footnote, poetic abbreviation of binoculars, and your jerkin of 1,000 pockets. May the avian god smile down on you on this day and all days. When walking, I often like to pretend I'm a car. Listen carefully when you cycle past me on a straight bit of road, and you'll most likely hear me making the noise of a family saloon accelerating. And with Oddie time now over, my imaginary car of choice is a Vauxhall Cascada. Obviously, I'd never drive one in real life, as it's a bit of a hairdresser's car, but in the land of make-believe, no such stigma applies. I'm looking for a ferry, and as I negotiate a corner by making the sound of a cascada dropping down a couple of gears, I notice a van bearing the distinctive livery of the BBC. It's an outside broadcast unit, and standing next to it is none other than CBBC's Steve Backshall. It's 7 p.m, so most of his supporters have been taken home by their mums. But Steve, ever keen to raise his own profile, is about to do an interview with the BBC's Neither One Thing Nor Another programme, The One Show, so-called because that's how many brain cells you need to watch it. Footnote. Eamon Holmes gave me that one. Love you, Aim. As they go on air, I'm delighted to see that the interviewer is Giles Brandreth. Now, I love Giles. A lot of people think he's just a privileged posh boy, but I've researched him on Wikipedia, and other than founding a teddy museum in 1998, which admittedly is a bit odd, Brandreth could hardly be more normal. Yet just because he went to private school, took to wearing a cape when at Oxford, and his middle name is Daubney, people suddenly think they can make judgments about him. Well, it's not on. I know loads of people called Daubney. Who doesn't? As I eat the last of my Asda ham, I watch the two men talk. Giles is, as ever, a class act. A raised eyebrow here, a touch on the arm there, a kindly nod while Backshall drones on, betraying not a jot of the contempt he must surely hold for the programme that employs him. But my eyes drawn to Backshall, his wide-eyed expression, his constant references to all the money he's raised, his cloying self-satisfaction and his laughter. Oh, the guy can't stop laughing. He's laughing right now. It seems that in Backshall world, everything is funny. Beaming and laughing and smiling and laughing and talking and laughing and fundraising and laughing and being Steve Backshall and laughing. I watch all of this spewing from his mouth like the suds from a cartoon washing machine gone haywire. He is so pleased with himself. You'd think no one else was doing a walk. Well, they are. Me. And with that, a thought suddenly erupts in my mind like one of those geezers that smells of Trumps. Footnote. It's at this moment that I realise I have actually trumped an unpleasant habit I'm working hard towards eradicating. Since my journey began, I've been doing my best to avoid the spotlight, but maybe I've got things anus about chest, footnote, arse about tit. The more I chew it over, the more I think that my father's memory shouldn't be hidden from view like some sausages in a fridge. We live in the age of sharing, linked up, Instagram and the like. If it's fair game to tell the whole world when you last took toilet or what you had for breakfast, perhaps sausages from the fridge, then surely it's only right that I should share the memory of the man who made me. And if it's fair game for Backshall to speak to the British public on the flagship Chit Chat magazine show, then it's surely only right for Partridge to peck at that pie too. It's one interview. Big deal. It's not like I'm making a 6-part Sunday night BBC One series about it. That ship has sailed. I'm fine with it. Move on. I jog over and thrust my hand towards Steve, calmly ignoring the producer's frantic gestures, telling me to keep back. Alan Partridge, I don't believe we've had the pleasure. I put the emphasis on pleasure so that we all know I mean the opposite. As our hands lock, we begin the traditional up-and-down greeting action. I quickly realise his shake is way firmer than mine. I try to get up to his level without him realising, but end up gritting my teeth, and I think he notices. Off-camera, the producer's still going bananas, and some of the stuff he's miming at me is pretty industrial. If this was Give Us a Clue, almost all of it would have to be cut, as I believe a lot of Lionel Blair's stuff was in the later years when he became increasingly blue. But Brandreth knows me. We once rehearsed a panto together, although my part, Twanky's friend, was subsequently cut before the opening night, and he welcomes me warmly. I start chatting and tell Giles and the viewers that I'm also doing a walk.
"How splendid," says Giles.
Now, there aren't many broadcasters who think to use a word like splendid on primetime TV, but I guess that's part of Giles' gift. He goes on,
"You and Steve are both in the midst of walks, but whereas your feet are shod, Steve's are, how to put this, al fresco."
Al fresco. Again, brilliant. I have no idea what he means, but it's quite brilliant. Then I realise Backshall has nothing on his feet. He's doing his sport relief walk with no shoes on. Of course, Sport Relief requires its annual celebrity to add a twist to the feat of endurance, be it asking David Williams to swim open-mouthed into sewage, or getting Eddie Izzard to drive 100 marathons in 100 days, and this is Backshall's angle, Zola budding it around the place like a wally. Wowzers, I say. I'm pretending to be impressed, but the arrogance staggers me, and I think it staggers Giles too. Who walks without shoes on? Who does he think he is? John Lennon from the Beatles? Then again, it does sound kind of fun. You know what, Steve? I'm going to walk with mine off, too. Well, I can almost hear the gasps. This is great TV. You'd think I'd be a bit rusty, not having been live in front of the nation for years, but I have come alive. Adrenaline's flying around my body like it used to when Angela said she'd made one of her chicken pies. Footnote. Call me, please. By now, my shoes and socks are off. I've decided to roll up my trousers and I'm hopping from foot to foot like a madman. Oh no, my feet haven't got any clothes on. What do I look like? I bet the viewers at home are killing themselves at this. Call the cops! Call the cops! My feet need to get arrested for indecent exposure. I've got to hand it to Giles. How on earth he isn't corpsing, I have no idea. Steve's blank expression is less surprising. Kids TV presenters tend to have a kid's sense of humour, so this stuff is probably straight over his head. Of course, little do they know, I have an ulterior motive. This isn't just some surreal outburst of physical comedy that bears comparison with the Best of the Goons show. I mean, it is that, but it's also something else. It's not often one gets a platform like this, and while Backshaw may be standing there like a pudding, I've seen the opportunity to tell people about my walk, and it's an opportunity I intend to seize with both feet. My calculations are simple. With my side-to-side jumping becoming increasingly frantic, people will be unable to take their eyes off me. In the 15 or so seconds before I become exhausted and have to stop for a nap, I'll outline the significance of my journey, list the towns I'll be passing through in the coming days, and recommend some spots to grab a bite to eat along the way. Just quote the word footsteps when making your booking for 10% off the bill. Offer does not include alcohol. It promises to be a mesmerizing piece of infotainment, and I can't help but snigger at how I'm about to totally own Steve Backshall. So we've heard all about Steve's walk, I mime a large yawning gesture, and although Giles doesn't laugh, I can tell he wants to. Well, now let's hear about my... Ow! Glass! That was glass! I've trodden on glass. I'm surprised at how much blood a heel contains. Then again, if blood is going to gather anywhere, it stands to reason it should be in the feet. I take off, wheeling around the car park like a spooked horse on its period. What a horrible image. Unaware that it's only a small cut, my first thoughts turn to crisis management. I scream at the top of my voice, "Tell the BBC they're sending me private. There's no way I'm using the NHS." "It's okay," replies Brandreth, as I complete my third circuit of the car park. "I'm sure they'll foot the bill." What an absolute a-hole. I vow there and then never to watch another episode of Countdown. And shag-a-dog, it had to be my left, didn't it? Ignore the film of the same name, because my left foot is the real story here. Several years ago, I pierced this foot on a spike whilst hurdling some railings to rescue a corporate function. After a series of operations and a dozen Paul McKenna hypnotherapy sessions, the foot finally stopped aching. Then, a few years ago, I was shot in the left ankle by a madman's shotgun. And now this gash. The gunshot wound, by the way, hurt like billio, and I've only just stopped telling people about it. Although I shall now start telling people about it again, as this will allow me to complete the following chapter. Chapter 21. You don't have to be mad to work here, but Pat was. People often ask me why I veer to the right on long walks. My answer is always the same. It's a bit of jip around my left ankle that flares up when I walk. A small hello from my body's nerve centre to me, like a poke from a divorcee you've not Facebooked for a while. The source of the pain, a small fragment of shotgun pellet, lodged next to the tibia and, according to the lady surgeon who delved into me, nothing to worry about whatsoever. The decision was made to leave the fragment in my body, and it's something I enjoy telling people about whenever I possibly can. Because it came from the barrel of a madman's shotgun, and it changed the way I look at everything. Even though the shot wasn't fatal, Alan Partridge died that day, and a new Alan Partridge was born. A wiser, cooler, kinder Partridge. A Partridge I've become rather fond of. To understand more, let me take you back to the summer of 2013. Q313 was an odd time for Alan Partridge, a period of flux, as evidenced by the daring hairstyle I'd developed, slightly looser, longer, Lucia Lanker style. You're never too old to experiment, although you wouldn't know it from the outraged response when I presented it to the world. "I don't understand why your hair is like that," people would say. "Like it frigging mattered. You don't even look like Alan anymore. Why is it like that? That's not Alan. Alan is shorter. Why have you made it long at the back? It shouldn't be long. Alan has short hair." Yes, just as I changed into a different Alan Partridge through the use of a cool new hairdo, So it was that change almost led to tragedy, although mercifully no one was hurt, with the exception of Michael, who died. I guess you could say that change is the theme of this chapter. As Cheryl Crow once squawked, "A change would do you good. I think a change would do you good. Oh, I think a change would do you good." And change can do you good, but only if managed correctly. Change is one of the most powerful forces known to science, be it small change like a caterpillar getting changed into a chrysalis, to large change like a menopausing woman. Yep, change is hard to resist, but whether you believe in evolution or revolution or devolution, you can't go in blunder-handed, because badly managed change, okay, can blow up in your face. Pause. Footnote. I should point out that this opening bit was lifted directly from a TED talk I wrote, but was subsequently not required to give. It's a shame a company called Gordale Media didn't consider any of this when they rode into town back in 2013. I'd had concerns about the strategic direction of North Norfolk Digital for some time. The 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. weekday slot seemed to be the only segment of the station's output that wasn't either horrendously conceived or appallingly executed. And that's not me having a go at my fellow DJs, that's just analysis. I knew my onions, don't forget. I'd created Forward Solutions, a unique business training program endorsed by none other than Chip Keeble. Footnote, who is American. So I was able to assess businesses with a clinical eye and a surgical ear. Within minutes of striding into any office or shop, I was and am able to identify failing processes, dream up an attitude matrix, suggest mantras that management must repeat to staff each morning, and generally map out a road path to collective betterment. And all without the mumbo-jumbo you often get from management consultants. And that's why I'd offered to come into North Norfolk Digital with a package of evening workshops hosted by me at a discounted rate, which would revolatilise, my word, the ailing station. My methodology was by now pretty watertight. Once everyone had kicked off their shoes and limbered up, I'd asked the group to debate among themselves and then divide up into heroes, the emphasis very much on positive change, remember, and cancers. The cancers were then asked to leave the station permanently. I called this the democratisation of dismissal. And the remainder would get to continue working there with the proviso that they adopt a set of non-negotiable recommendations relating to their future conduct. Yes, it was tough love, but I'd been shown a film called Glenn, Gary Glenn, Ross, basically a movie version of The Apprentice, and it had increased my toughness by a factor of 2. I was convinced it would turn North Norfolk Digital into a viable, robust and agile 21st century business. Unfortunately, the powers that be felt that they knew best and declined my offer. So you'll forgive me if my ghast wasn't exactly flabbered. Footnote. This is a phrase first used by Paul Ross in 1990 that I've always found deliciously clever. When, 6 months later, Gordale Media, the station's new owners, sought to make a few changes of their own, and the whole place kicked off big time. A radio station is a piece of precision engineering. It's like a Swiss watch or a Segway. Its equilibrium is delicate. You can't remove a cog here or a wheel there, or a DJ over there without causing a few shockwaves. It's like chaos theory. If a butterfly flaps its wings in the boardroom, an Irishman's going to go berserk in Studio 2. And that is exactly what happened, with the exception of the butterfly bit, which didn't. The closest North Norfolk Digital has ever had to its own butterfly was a moth infestation above a ceiling tile in the women's toilets. The Irishman in question was Pat Farrell, whose weekday evening show, Roll Out the Farrell, had been a feature of the station's output for years, in the same way a benign mole is a feature of a woman's back. It's not a problem per se, but you'd rather it wasn't there. Or at least that was the prevailing view. Personally, I had no beef with Pat. I would have loved for him to stay. It was the bosses who wanted to get rid of him. I even volunteered to stand up for Pat at a meeting of the company's top brass. But when I got to the boardroom, the door was jammed, so I couldn't get in. All I heard was them mumbling about Pat's union activities and his foul mouth. I was desperate to make them see sense. Just save Pat, for God's sake, I wanted to say. But the door had other ideas and stayed jammed. There was nothing I could do but walk away from the jammed door. Later that day, Pat was dismissed. I wanted to console him, but I could tell from his body language that he wanted to be alone. As Pat strode from the building to the snarky sniggers of his former friends, I stood alone with a sense of unease. Something about his expression said to me he wasn't going to take this lying down. I knew there and then that he was a security threat, and we all needed to be on our guard, brackets, sss. But the others were too busy sniggering to heed my misgivings. "Oh, come on, Alan, why aren't you sniggering?" said one. "We're all sniggering, why aren't you?" said another. "Why don't you snigger for a bit with us?" said a third. "Nah," I said, my eyes still trained on the door. "You guys snigger without me. I gotta check something out." I looked at them, smiled wryly, and jogged off. Minutes later, I was in the office of station manager Greg Frampton, pleading with him to beef up security ahead of that night's party. It was a party to usher in the new brand for the station. Shape, the way you want it to be. I admit that at the time, I liked the brand. Shape felt modern and powerful. It also felt satisfying inside the mouth. I liked saying it. Shape. Shape. The soft velvet of the unvoiced fricative we know as shh, followed by the gentle plop of the pea going pop. Others weren't so sure, whether it was because they didn't understand marketing or were just opposed to radio stations sounding like yogurts. There was a febrile atmosphere that night. But Greg wasn't listening to me, nor were any of the management team when I raised the issue with them, and that's where I left it. And that eats me up. Maybe I should have done more, said more, shouted more, slapped the desk more. Maybe I should have trashed the place and forced the postponement of the party by reason of a capsized buffet table. But I didn't. And God, that's hard for me to live with. I'm just thankful that no one was hurt, brackets with the exception of Michael, who died. Because little did my cackling colleagues realize how hard the news had hit Pat. You see, Pat was one of those DJs who thought he was entitled to a job for life. Perhaps he once worked at the BBC, I don't know. And when that job was taken away, he reacted badly. To put it bluntly, without wanting to attract the ire of mental health charities, he was a div who went schizo. Fast forward to the party itself. The air crackled with chit-chat and fizzed with fizz. Normally Partridge would be in his element. This was a man who was pretty much defined by small talk and had hosted the Land Rover East of England charity auction twice in as many years. But not tonight. Tonight I hung back, leaning against a wall with my knee crooked so that the sole of one shoe was flat against the wall just below my bum. It's a good stance, and I was good at doing it. Not dissimilar to the way a schoolboy stands against the wall of a sports hall when they're about to do shuttle runs. People were letting their hair down, but the only thing that Partridge was letting down was not his guard. That was until I saw a woman in a state of distress, who I vaguely recognised as an assistant at the local ice rink. I froze, like the very ice at the rink I'd just mentioned. And I knew that if I didn't help her into a cab, I'd be on thin ice, like the very ice at the rink I'd just mentioned before health and safety inspectors got involved. So I helped this debilitating Welsh woman into a waiting car.
"Come with me," she pleaded. "Make love to me, please."
Partridge smiled wistfully and looked down and then far away.
"I see," she whispered. "Your heart belongs to another."
Partridge smiled even wistfullier, and she nodded.
"Then go to her."
Partridge looked her in the eye, then gave her one of the best handshakes she'd ever had. He went inside to be with the woman he was falling for, a receptionist by the name of Angela, which is Latin or Spanish for angel. He can't have been gone for more than a minute, but in that minute hell had been deployed. Farrell was in the building brandishing a shotgun. Shots had been fired. Partridge had two choices, flee or front up, and boy did he front up. Farrell was wild, incoherent, his shouting a mixture of personal grievance and Irish Republican dogma. Yet Partridge approached, making a shushing sound and rolling up the sleeves of his leather jacket to show he wasn't packing heat. The other men in the room were packing heat, if you accept packing heat as a euphemism for shitting your pants. You could literally hear and smell these men. It's only fair that I name them. Danny Sinclair, Greg Frampton, Jason Tresswell. Involuntarily filling their pants with warm excreta until they were well and truly packing heat. Horrible and demeaning for them to read this, but important that I paint a full picture of that room.
"Shh, shh, shh,"
Partridge continued, every inch of the gunman whisperer. And the gunman span round to face him. It was only now that Partridge realised what a huge man Farrell was. Broad of shoulder and with that muscular backside you get on some men, he was, according to one witness statement, a strong man with strong arms and a good walk. Partridge could certainly vouch for that. "Let these people go, Pat."
Never! Screamed the irate Irishman. Never! Never!
Then I'll be forced to alert the authorities.
You're not feckin' goin' anywhere,
he spluttered, his Irish accent clogging up his throat like an unclean dishwasher filter. Partridge looked back at him.
Oh, yeah?
And with that he ran, darting this way and that as bullets zipped and fussed and tum-tummed and pitowed past him, each missing by millimetres at the most. Rounding a corner, he saw sidekick Simon, unable to handle the tension any more, and quite an odd man anyway, literally clobbering himself with a fire extinguisher in a bid to achieve unconsciousness. Anything to take the fear away. Partridge stopped for a second. Why don't you step with me? Footnote, come with me. But Simon was unresponsive. Partridge knew he had to save the others. So he, Partridge, as in I, me, not sure how, or when I slipped into the third person apologies, commandeered a vehicle and drove to a police station. Suddenly things moved very quickly. From a short list, I was selected to be the go-between that goes between the cops and the gunman. I was briefed by a tactical firearms unit. Don't be a hero, Alan, they said. I nodded, but they knew I couldn't promise that. After another round of excellent handshakes, I approached the building. I was back in. The scene I found on my return chilled me to my gut. I was in the heart of darkness. It was clear that Farrell, like Marlon Brando in that film where he was all fat in the jungle, had gone quite mad. He was dressed as a Mexican, complete with handlebar moustache and a poncho, an item of clothing I could no longer stand, annoying as I used to wear a plastic rain poncho at the Goodwood Revival Festival to protect my suit. The atmosphere was eerie. In the station, I mean, not at Goodwood, where it's pretty upbeat and pleasingly conservative. While along the station corridors and within the studios, death was in the air, although it turned out to be just the fecal stench of Danny Sinclair, Greg Frampton and Jason Tresswell, who'd continued to soil themselves. I somehow managed to calm Farrell down and gain his trust, and then put him at ease by broadcasting with him. Later people would say my decision to broadcast was crass and opportunistic. I simply say this, it was not. And also this, go shaft yourself. I would also like to add something about their mothers. Farrell was still a very, very dangerous man, consumed by grief for both the death of his wife and perhaps the failure of Ireland to unite and govern itself. He was like a bear with a sore head and a shotgun. Somehow, though, Partridge succeeded in establishing a calm environment, one in which Pat was able to produce radio of the highest quality and in which the North Norfolk Digital team was able to foster a genuine camaraderie. Footnote. A bond developed that day, as we learnt from each other and about each other. For example, we learnt that the cleaner's name was Chastity, and more surprisingly, she spoke English as her first language. Well, that came as news to us all, even though she'd cleaned for us for 5 years. The secret to the camaraderie? Forward Solutions. Every technique I employed within the siege was lifted directly from Forward Solutions, An Imbecile's Guide by Alan Partridge, YTBP. Footnote, yet to be published. Every last one. That surely says something about the programme and its creator, which is why it absolutely perplexes me that Forward Solutions hasn't had a paying client since 2009. What more can you ask than a peacefully resolved siege from which the participants emerge enriched, emboldened, and crucially unharmed, with the exception of Michael, who died. But no, FS didn't form part of the post-siege narrative at all. Instead, my involvement was reduced to a footnote. Footnote. Like this. As my colleagues jostled to claim credit for my bravery, my position wasn't helped by the hastily scribbled publishing deals that gave cash-in books from Danny Sinclair, 3 days in Norfolk, Jason Tresswell, dead air, Chastity the Cleaner, my name is Chastity, and Dave Clifton, Colossal Velocity. Nor was my marketability boosted by the photograph that came to define my time in the siege, taken after I'd auto-defenestrated and lost my trousers on a window latch. Snapped from behind by Murray Martin, a slimeball photographer who probably beats off to these images in his darkroom, the snap showed yours truly from behind after I'd stowed my cock and balls up between my legs and against my backside, the genitals seemingly peeping from between my thighs like the head of a shy bird. As one colleague said, first time I'd ever seen a dick look frightened. There are some who say I had the chance to rescue my reputation and blew it, and yes, there's some merit in that argument. because while broadcasting from the radio station's former roadshow bus as Farrell was driving it to the coast, I struck a genuine chord with the public by tearing a strip off the bully boy tactics of Gordale Media, and for a few days was something of a folk hero. But I stand by what I did next, which was retract my comments while I was next on air and offer Gordale Media a full and frank apology. You can't muck around with your career like that. So no, I didn't get a book deal. Not that I've ever had a desire to write about my experience. If I'm going to write a book about anything, it'll be about walking / my father, thanks very much. Chapter 22. Standing at the Crossroads of My Mind. Well, my foot is sore as all heck and still oozing red like a squashed jammy doughnut. Along with the backshawl fiasco, the injury has cost me a whole heap of time. With my shoes back on, that was a fun 20 minutes, I arrive at the port. It is shut, or to use boating parlance, she is shut, or to use pirate parlance, she be shut. The last ferry of the day taking pedestrians over the water to Gravesend has already left. As luck would have it, I'm able to hitch a lift over in a coracle. Truth be told, it's not a coracle at all, it's a small fishing boat. I've always wanted to go in a coracle, and that's why I fibbed. It's getting late in Gravesend, as it is everywhere in the UK's time zone, and with the local B&Bs either closed or full or terrible, I've got a problem on my hands. And it's not just on my hands. Sleep is a requirement for the whole body. With my mood now as black as an NHS filling, I switch from walking to trudging. I pass along a main road, through an industrial estate, under a bridge, and into a small park. I stop and look up at the star-spattered sky. I can't remember the names of the constellations, but I'm pretty sure one's named after a ride at Alton Towers. Suddenly, three bullet points flash into my mind, and I'm pleased to see that my brain has ignored the default bullet, a simple black dot, and picked a slightly more stylish one, presumably by going to format, then bullets and numbering. But I also note, and this is perhaps more important, that the list offers a neat summary of my current mental state. You don't know where you are, you don't know what you're doing, you don't have any ham left. I dwell on this for a moment and then, in what I must emphasise is a totally unsexual way, begin to lick out the empty ham packet. The few remaining drops of meat sweat, no match for the heft and power of my tongue. The hit of the saline briefly lifts my spirits. Of course it does, how could it not? But then the content of the first two bullets comes to me again in the form of three additional bullets. It's true you don't know where you are. It's true you don't know what you're doing. And let me add something else. You feel isolated and alone. This is how I feel. I long for the familiarity of home, the comfort of my own bed, and, as I say, a bit of ham wouldn't go amiss either. I mean, what the hell am I doing here? Trudging the historic route of my forefather, for what? Using my eyes, I look round the park. It's empty save for a single unhomed man sitting on a bench. Another day in paradise, I say to myself, pleased that the Phil Collins reference has come to me easily. I want to think about Collins more, a lot more, but the elderly vagrant waves to me. Jesus, I think, not now. The last time I was cornered by a tramp in a park, he tried to rope me into a pyramid scheme, where you find 10 people to sell loose cigarettes and then find 10 people, and, well, I don't remember the details, but it sounded on paper like absolute guff. But still, this man is waving. Because he's homeless, I'm immediately scared. No, thank you, I say. I wasn't asking you anything. Pardon? I said I wasn't asking you anything. There was no question to say no to. So why are you waving? He shrugs. All the lonely people, where do they all come from? Ipswich, I suggest. The man laughs a throaty laugh, like his gullet needed a visit from Dinah Rod. It seems a bit weird that I just did a music reference, Collins, and now he's done one too, Beatles. But I guess it's a free country, so he's well within his rights. As a person, he's exceptionally unkempt. One side of his hair has started to form a single dreadlock, while the other is lank and fine. It's as if he's a pair of Siamese twins joined at the hairstyle. Yet something compels me to approach. If he tries anything funny, I know I can always slap him in the face, but to my surprise, his features soften. I don't mean he's melting. I just mean he now wears a kindly expression. "Everything all right?" he says. He has a friendly voice, and it's a pleasant surprise to meet a homeless person who isn't from Glasgow. I plonk myself down next to him, though obviously not right next to him. "Well, you know Steve Backshall," I begin. "Nope," That figures. Doesn't matter, I say, and he hands me his bottle of sherry.
Here, looks like you need it.
I'm a little thrown by this vagrant. He seems so normal. Pyramid scheme man had a way of saying, I know not, and using the word for instead of because, which made him sound like a character from Lord of the Rings or that TV series with boobs and dragons. I bet he was called something like Arador or Gondol. But this guy...
I'm Brian, by the way. Hello, Brian. I'm Alan Partridge.
Well, I almost spit out my sherry. I had no idea I had a following in the homeless community. I'm angry at myself for being so judgmental. Just because he's homeless doesn't mean he's not capable of standing outside Curry's and looking in at the TVs. Brian had been aware of my career from way back in the 90s, when I was a sports presenter on the hard-hitting news programme The Day Today. He claims I once did an interview at a racetrack in which I mistook a jockey for a child, and while I have no memory of this and doubt he's got it right, I'm touched by his enthusiasm for my canon. Footnote, not a euphemism.
So what brings you here, Alan?
Doing walk in footsteps of father, I answer. The phrasing's a bit weird, but I think it might be because of the bullet point thing earlier. I tell him about the box I found in my attic, about how I'd been so certain until then that my dad was a no-good idiot, and now...
And now the kaleidoscope's been shaken, he says. The pieces are in flux. I get that. It's disorientating.
And now here I am in a park, going nowhere. I'm going absolutely no... He silences me by putting his fingers to my lips. They smell of cigarettes and beef crisps.
Nowhere,
he says, shaking his head.
Sounds to me like you've got a purpose, Alan. And purpose goes a long way.
God, this guy's good. I take another swig of sherry. God, this sherry's good. It's like sherry trifle, but without the trifle. He's right. I do have a purpose. It's funny how it can be easier to share your most intimate feelings with complete strangers than with people closest to you. I once revealed to a woman on a plane that I was still wetting the bed when I was 18. It wasn't even true. I just felt the urge to confess something because she was a stranger. Footnote. Of course she didn't know this and later betrayed my confidence by posting it online where it's now widely regarded as fact. Every cloud has a silver lining, though, and 2 months ago I was delighted to accept the invitation to become a patron of the local incontinence charity. Conversely, I told my ex-wife Carol almost nothing. Well, not at the start. At the start I told her everything. At the start we were inseparable. I adored her, and she completed me. But years later, when she cheated on me with a fitness instructor and moved out, I took the decision to cut back. Footnote. First up, I resolved not to tell her things in person. Brackets, not that I've seen her since, but if I had, believe me, I would have told that which the square root of F all. Ditto on phone calls. Again, not been any, but wouldn't have said anything if there had. It was different with letters, because obviously I'd be sending those pretty regularly to beg that she came back to me. In truth, of course, the joke was actually on her. It may have appeared that I was bearing my soul, and that I had to keep starting again because the tears were smudging the ink, but in fact I wasn't that bothered about winning her back. I was only really doing it because, unbeknownst to her, cohabiting worked out better for me from a tax point of view. In the end, she didn't return to me, but that's not really relevant. Yet sitting here next to this sage old tramp, I feel there's something mystical going on. I almost want to say ethereal, but I have to check its exact definition first. Here I am, or here I be, in pirate speak, in a foreign environment in the dead of night, seemingly detached from place and time, and I feel I can tell Brian anything. We talk long into the night, me about my father, he about his, passing the bottle of sherry back and forth like it's a speak ball. Footnote. Speak ball is an American counselling technique devised originally in correctional facilities and Jewish summer camps, in which a ball is passed back and forth between the offenders slash teenagers to determine who should speak. It's a hugely effective and fun way to get youngsters and or violent sex offenders to really open up. Possession of the ball gives the chat much-needed structure, whilst the gentle toss and catch makes the activity feel like a sporty parlour game, delighting children and adults alike. He turns to face me, and for one terrifying moment I think he's going to kiss me. Instead, just as I'm about to slap him, he leans across and envelops me in a great big hug. I exhale loudly. I needed this. Yes, I'm a willing huggy, leaning further and further into the embrace, my face now buried deep in Brian's overcoat, which stinks no more and no less than I imagined it would. It's then that I realized he isn't hugging me. He's actually just leaning across to rifle through the bin. Remember, to a no-homer, bins are like supermarkets. We're in Gravesend, so it's likely to be more Morrisons than Waitrose, but, and this is lovely writing, beggars literally can't be choosers. With Brian distracted, I wipe away my tears. Not that I was crying particularly, but I wipe them away all the same. I think I hear him say the words, "I've hit the fucking jackpot here," and when he leans away from the bin, he's holding a pack of Jaffa cakes. They're past their best before date, and the chocolate's gone all ashen like E.T. does when he goes all ashen. But Brian doesn't mind. "Thanks for listening," I say, looking around the park, grateful to have found common ground on this piece of common ground. I didn't think anyone would be interested.
"Are you kidding me?"
Still managing to sound wise through a mouthful of mashed Jaffa.
"What's more interesting than how our fathers shape us, and how we use that shape to shape the world? The journey you're going on, Alan. People write books about that."
"Yes, and make TV shows." I laugh and tell him about Harvey Kennedy and his golden geese, Portillo, Balding, Bradbury.
"And why not Partridge?"
he smiles. I smile and explain that, yes, for a while, honouring my father and making a television programme about it had been a flight of fancy I'd indulged. And yes, I'd gone as far as trumpeting it on BBC One's The One Show. Had he heard of The One Show? He hadn't heard of The One Show. But Harvey Kennedy wasn't contactable, slash lacked honour. So the footsteps of my father television project was ironically as dead as the very father I was now focused on privately honouring. But by now, Brian is on a roll. God, I love him. He seems to think it could easily be formatted up into a 6-part series in which I crisscross the country, recreating intensely personal journeys made by famous historical figures.
"Walking in the footsteps of other people's fathers," as he puts it.
Bit sexist, but there you go. He's convinced that with a couple of days shooting, expansive external shots, with judicious use of voiceover, this walk could still be turned into the series opener, describing it, and this is something I'm pretty sure I've never heard a homeless person say before, as proof of concept. He feels very strongly that it's in the same sweet spot as Portillo's Great British Railway Journeys or Canal Walks with Julia Bradbury, and he reminds me that Julia gets wonderfully remunerated. Although instead of saying the words "wonderfully remunerated," he just says, "Bradbury gets," then takes my phone and types out 3 pound symbols. Pound, pound, pound. I tell him he should be the BBC's commissioning editor for factual entertainment. He laughs, but I'm not even joking right now. Not that the Beeb deserves him. His wisdom would be wasted at Broadcasting House. He should fly himself out to India. I know he has almost no money, but BA do some good deals at this time of year, and Hindu holy men, who are basically just homeless fellas themselves, are widely revered. Maybe he could become one of them. I realise Brian's still talking.
"At the very least, you should go see this Kennedy guy. If he said he was interested in your walk, you should follow it up."
"Too late," I tell him. "Besides, it's the start of a bank holiday weekend, Brian. Now, that won't mean a whole heap to you, but..."
"Turn up at his door," he suggests, "like I do when I miss my kids."
I'm touched by his passion, even though I'm sure he's already told me he doesn't have any kids. And I tell him that if I were 20 years younger, I'd definitely have tried to pitch it. But after Harvey let me down and the whole Backshall mess... "No," I tell him, "I have different priorities these days. Although I'm very tired now and can't recall what they are." Our conversation is at an end, and in a final act of quite staggering kindness, Brian offers me his bed, the bench, and lies down on the grass nearby. "Night, Brian."
"Sleep well, Alan. Swig of sherry?"
"Oh, no more drink for me, thanks."
"No, I mean as mouthwash."
And with that he gargles the celebrated cooking liquor and blasts it from his mouth into a hedge.
"Night, night."
What a guy.